From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. And I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, insurance fraud can take many forms, from staged car crashes to Medicaid schemes. Coming up in the second half of the program, the New York Alliance Against Insurance Fraud tells us what you can do to protect yourself from insurance fraud. And we've got the latest from Overlook News reporting on the Catskills, including a new housing development proposed for the town of Ulster, and a mama bear and cub found inside a Catskills home. Those stories all coming up. First, we're going to start with news from Albany, where groups that help crime victims are sounding the alarm because they've lost millions of dollars in state funding. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind reports.
Dozens of organizations that run domestic violence shelters and rape crisis programs are grappling with sudden funding cuts. The groups recently learned that the state's Office of Victim Services approved a new round of grants, but the awards went down. Liz Roberts is CEO of Safe Horizon, the nation's largest victim assistance group. She says the state needs a clear strategy about what it's funding and where.
Instead, it's this wide open free-for-all, and they keep spreading the money around more and more thinly.
A spokesperson for the office says there was record demand for funding and it had to make difficult decisions. Officials say the state is spending $127 million to help victims this year. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
Now, some more news on this issue. A New York City-based organization is expanding its reach and evolving into the state's new anti-sexual violence coalition. The Alliance Against Sexual Violence will support and work with the 54 rape crisis centers in New York, along with other organizations across the state. The announcement comes as groups responded to funding cuts in the latest state budget. The Alliance's executive director, Emily Miles, says those cuts make their work even more critical.
As long as there are survivors, we will be there to make sure that those organizations have the resources that they need and that survivors, all survivors across New York State, regardless of their zip code, have equal access to trauma-informed services.
Statewide coalitions originated under the Federal Violence Against Women Act as a way to help local groups support survivors. President Trump was in his home state on Friday, giving a full endorsement to Republican Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman as he campaigns against Governor Hochul. The president said at a rally on Long Island that Blakeman has hired more police officers and worked with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to deport undocumented immigrants who committed crimes.
We got to get Bruce in there. Nowhere is the communist attack on American society more clear than here in New York State.
A recent poll shows 60% of likely New York voters view Trump unfavorably. Democrats say President Trump has hurt New Yorkers by cutting health care funding. They say tariffs and the Iran war have increased the cost of fuel and consumer goods. Blakeman thanked Trump for his endorsement. And now some development news from Albany that's also archaeological news. Advocates and archaeologists are working to excavate the southeast end of the Erie Canal's Old Lock 1 in Albany after locating the buried structure earlier this month. Grant Ashley of the New York Public News Network has more.
The Albany County-funded excavation was the first step in a proposed redevelopment of downtown Albany. The project was designed by artist Len Tantillo 30 years ago. It calls for restoring the historic Canal Lock 1, building a working marina along the Hudson River, and putting in a plaza. It would cost over $200 million. SUNY Polytechnic professor Andy Wolf is leading the excavation of Lock 1. He says it was 18 inches underground and in good condition.
Part of what we're doing is seeing if this is a viable lock. And since it is, now the question becomes, you know, how do we get the money for making Len Tantillo's dream a reality? That's the big question. That's the politicians. I don't have $200 million.
Wolf will continue excavating the lock on weekdays from 1 to 4 in the afternoon through the end of August. He says visitors are welcome. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Grant Ashley.
And thank you to the New York Public News Network for those reports. Now let's get the latest news from the Catskills, including a Wyndham seeking more hotel rooms and a mother bear and cub spotted in a Catskills home. Tim Bruno spoke with Noah Exyth, editor-in-chief of The Overlook, on Radio Chatskill this morning. He starts off telling us about a new housing development, Zena Homes, that has been proposed in the town of Ulster.
Yeah, so the town of Ulster Planning Board last week issued a negative declaration under SEAKER, the State Environmental Quality Review Act, for the proposed subdivision of Zena Homes, which is in both the towns of Ulster and Woodstock. We're a Woodstock community news outlet, and we're covering this because the proposed entrance and egress to this 30-home subdivision would be in the town of Woodstock on Eastwoods Drive. So the planning board voted last week to determine that this extremely controversial project is unlikely to have significant adverse environmental impacts, which Woodstock Land Conservancy and the community organizing group Stop Zena Development categorically think otherwise. They think there would be huge adverse effect to the marshlands and the different migratory birds and amphibians that live in the Zena woods where this would take place.
So now what does that mean for environmental review, and what are the major environmental concerns that opponents are still continuing to raise?
So it will have to go through a site plan review, and Woodstock Land Conservancy had challenged the town of Ulster's decision to have this play out in the planning board. Woodstock Land Conservancy wanted this to play out in the town board, but last week at the zoning board, they decided that it should be with the planning board. So that challenge was sort of tossed. What Andy Mossy, who's the executive director of the Woodstock Land Conservancy, has told me is that because of recent changes to SEAKER law, that they won't be able to appeal the negative declaration until site plan review is over.
That's the State Environmental Quality Review Act in New York, the SEAKER law. Meanwhile, in Windham, the Mountain Club is seeking approval for a 26-room hotel. What's the debate over whether Windham actually needs additional hotel rooms, and why is the club proposing this now?
So our full-time staff reporter, Connor Greco, who we brought on in June, has been doing a great job, expanding our coverage to Hunter and Windham. And he has been, following this story as it progresses through Windham Planning Board. And what he's reporting is that the planning board appears likely to advance an amendment to the Mountain Club's already approved master plan. That they originally had a plan for 8 townhouses, but they're replacing it with this plan for a 26-room luxury hotel. Other hotels in Windham are opposing this. They wrote a letter to the planning board. They have concerns that the hotel would change a level of community character. But what the general manager of Windham Mountain Club, Kristen Leach, is saying is that this hotel would be appealing to a clientele that is not already going to Windham, so it wouldn't be taking away from their business, even though, over the past year they are reporting these other Windham hotels that occupancy has been low. So they're questioning how this is a viable business, but in SEAKER review, that's not really a consideration. At least it's not a main consideration.
So beyond the economic question and this potential high-end market they're thinking that would be serving, what are the concerns about environmental issues or lighting, traffic, and the character of the surrounding neighborhood?
Yeah. Representatives of 4 area hotels argued in a July 28th letter that the proposal could harm Wyndham's community character. So there's concerns, but the planning board, seems poised to get this through to the next stage for a site plan review.
And finally, a very different kind of Catskill story, but probably not that unusual. A bear and a cub in the area of Woodstock entered a home, and the homeowner's dog was injured, but is okay, I think. What happened?
Yeah, thankfully, Blue, the 8-year-old tiny dog that Susan Brown, an 80-year-old writer and editor who's lived in Woodstock, you know, for such a long time. The first time she came to Woodstock was 1967. But on August 9th, you know, she has sort of a sunroom that she keeps closed, and then she has the door usually on, you know, breezy days open into the living room, but the sunroom's always closed. But she hears barking in the living room, and a bear and her cub, who she's familiar with, they've been around the neighborhood for, you know, they're just a stone's throw away from the Woodstock hamlet of Bearsville. So, you know, being in the Catskills, where about a third of New York State's black bear population exists, it's not uncommon to see bears.
Yeah, I meant to say that it's not uncommon to have bears around. Maybe uncommon to have them come into your house, but they're around.
Yeah. Absolutely. So she hears Blue barking. The bear, she goes in, she sees the bear, the cub in her living room. The bear sort of swats or bites the dog. It's unclear. The dog has some flesh wounds, broke its foot, but is expected to make a full recovery. But as Susan starts, as she told me, she started cursing at the bear, and she said that once you start doing that, the bear really starts to move. So it seems like they understand English curse words. But so she thought she gets the bear out of the house, but she wound up trapping it in the kitchen by accident. At that point, she called the cops, and the cops came and got the bear out safely. But interestingly, you know, I love this story because everybody's okay, and it's a bit of narrative, but it also is, you know, we spoke to the DEC about what people can do. And also Susan told me that the DEC asked her if she wanted them to euthanize the mother, you know, the mother bear, which they sometimes do. The mother bear has three cubs, and at this stage in the cubs' lives, they could be self-sufficient is what the DEC said. But she said categorically, absolutely not. You know, that we live with bears and this is their home as much as it is hers. So it wound up being, you know, just a story about how to stay safe when bears are out and how to keep yourself safe and bear wise, but also how we can coexist, you know, in the woods with bears.
Yeah. I mean, it's a complicated relationship between residents and black bears, but nice to hear that she wanted to let those that family stay together, I suppose. But also, it is a good reminder of staying safe. Bear Wise is actually a national program developed by bear biologists to help communities reduce conflict between people and bears. Any other reminders that folks should take away from this incident about how they can prevent bears from getting near or inside the home?
Yeah, I mean, lock your garbage. So when I went over to Susan's house, I also met her neighbor who has young children, and they're up early anyway with a 6-month-old at 4:30, but the garbage trucks come at 4:45, so they're going out at 4:44 to bring the garbage out. They're not leaving garbage out. You know, keep your doors locked. Do not put garbage outside. You know, there was an instance where Susan had a tenant, and they left some garbage out, and the bear picked up on that. And it's difficult. We're going to monitor this because what the DEC told me is that once a bear makes a connection that they can find food in someone's home and they've gotten into the food, they most likely will come back. So the DEC gave her these motion activated sensors near her front door and back door. So if a bear goes by, a loud sound goes off and alerts the bear.
Which is actually called a critter getter.
A critter getter?
Yeah, the picture on the website is a close-up of it. It's critter getter, property of NYSDEC. All of this great reporting from The Overlook is at theoverlooknews.com, community nonprofit journalism serving Hunter, Hurley, Olive, Saugerties, Shindig, and Windham, and Woodstock. And we've been talking to Editor-in-Chief Noah Eckstein. Noah, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tim.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Insurance fraud can take many forms, from staged car crashes and fraudulent medical claims to schemes involving Medicaid, property damage, even arson. New York Alliance Against Insurance Fraud recently released its annual Filthy Five, highlighting five of the most outrageous alleged insurance fraud cases uncovered across New York State this year. Among them, a $120 million Medicaid and Medicare fraud case in Queens, a $35 million medical transportation scheme, alleged phantom eye surgeries, and a Southern Tier multi-fire arson ring involving multiple structure fires, allegedly arranged as part of an insurance fraud scheme. Frank Stuck is a spokesperson for the New York Alliance Against Insurance Fraud and Senior Vice President of Investigative Services for the Delta Group. Radio Catskills' Patricia Arbayo recently caught up with him.
Frank, before we get into, you know, the individual's cases, what exactly qualifies as insurance fraud and how widespread is it in New York?
Okay. I think the simplest way to explain insurance fraud is it's the abuse of the insurance system for financial gain. Now, it takes many forms and it's done by many different types of people, both individuals, corporations. It's even done in some cases by insurance companies. So, you know, insurance fraud literally is somebody just taking advantage of the insurance system.
And your organization recently highlighted five of the most outrageous alleged insurance fraud schemes uncovered in New York so far this year. Which case of those five stands out to you most, and what allegedly has happened?
I think there's a couple ways of looking at that. One of the things that we're seeing, and we have to remember that Medicare and Medicaid fraud is insurance fraud. And if you look at the case out of Queens, where $120 million was stolen from the Medicaid and Medicare system, I think that's just an egregious abuse of that form of insurance. And the reality of it is it impacted not only the people involved, but it also impacts every one of us, because it hurts not only in the cost of insurance, but also in the cost of all goods and services, Patricio. So we've got to understand that. So, I mean, that case in and of itself is huge. And it also, when you look at that case, it lends itself to some of the things that are happening on a national stage. And that's, you know, adult daycare fraud, you know, and we hear a lot about hospice fraud and, you know, child learning fraud. And it really is just endemic of some of the things that we're seeing in our industry right now.
Yeah. Like I mentioned in the intro, that insurance fraud is sometimes thought of as a victimless crime because the immediate target appears to be like the larger insurance companies. But if you could talk about how these fraudulent claims affect ordinary people, ordinary New Yorkers, and how the premiums go up that they pay.
Oh, sure. I mean, let's just talk about automobile insurance, for instance. New Yorkers are paying some of the highest automobile premiums in the country. And every incidence of fraud impacts the cost of insurance. And as I said a couple minutes ago, it also impacts the affordability on a general basis for our citizens in New York. Think about it. You know, even the cost of a cup of coffee is a little more expensive at your local coffee shop because of insurance fraud, because every commercial entity has to have insurance. So when you look at it from that perspective, if insurance fraud is raising the rates, then, you know, what are the merchants going to do in order to afford their insurance? They're going to have to raise the rates on their goods and services to the general public. So this whole concept of insurance fraud as being just impacting the cost of insurance is really only part of the question. And the reality of it is it's impacting everybody. And when people cheat the system, you know, especially an automobile, when people cheat the system, honest drivers are the ones that are really being impacted.
And speaking about car crashes, you know, I've seen a lot of social media folks now having dash cams and seeing, you know, almost firsthand of how some of these fake car crashes happen. You know, those backing into cars, you know, just say that they ran into them. How organized are these operations for car insurance, car fraud?
A lot of these operations are very organized, and it really is. We're looking at it almost as organized crime now. And I'm glad you brought up the dash cam, because invariably I've been doing a lot of media presentations this year on, you know, to coincide with our New York Alliance Against Insurance Fraud annual campaign. Mm-hmm. And I'm always asked the question, how do people avoid being a victim? And you brought up the dash cam, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I was going to bring it up, because it's probably one of the greatest tools that people can put in their car at a minimal cost to try to, to try to avoid being a victim of a staged accident. And, you know, that's an emerging fraud problem around the New York area. And it's not just downstate, it's upstate as well. And, you know, we've got to remember that a staged accident is a fake accident. Now, when I say it's a fake accident, there's obviously a collision involved, but in a staged case, it's being done for the sole purpose of committing insurance fraud, of getting people to doctors, getting people to unscrupulous doctors, to getting people to unscrupulous lawyers who are looking to game the system along with the organizers of these staged accidents. So is every staged accident part of an organized crash? The answer is no. And, you know, one of the things that I say to people all over the state, you know, beside getting a dash cam, is drive smartly. Okay, don't tailgate. Because if you're tailgating somebody, you're just inviting a potential staged accident. So if I'm out driving around and I'm all by myself and I'm looking to cause an accident, when somebody's tailgating, I'll look in my rearview mirror and wait for that person's moment of distraction. And I'm going to slam on my brakes. That person's going to hit me from behind. And the rule of thumb is, If you strike somebody from the rear, they're full. Mm. When in reality, you're a victim of a staged accident. People need to be aware that, you know, be aware of their surroundings. Don't tailgate. Get a dash cam. And then if they're involved in an accident, okay, there's certain things they can do to protect themselves. Everybody's got a car, has a camera now. Everybody's got a camera in their phone for the most part. Take pictures of the damage or the lack of damage. Take pictures of the people in the car that you're involved in the accident with. Make sure that you call the police regardless of the amount of damage that occurs in that accident. These are all good steps to try to curtail that problem of staged accident fraud.
I just want to go over the list here. I'll read them out here. Number one list you have that was sent was Flushing Adult Care Center fraud. Number two was an alleged $35 million Medicaid transportation scheme on Long Island. Number three is alleged $9 million phantom eye surgery. And number four is an alleged arson for insurance scheme in Franklin County. And number five, which I want to talk about because it's near our listening area here, number five is the Southern Tier Multi-Fire Arson Ring. Which can end, really end tragically, because we had an arson here a couple of years ago, a person who was arrested multiple times and kept setting fires in abandoned houses, and ultimately ended up, you know, losing the life of one of the volunteer firefighters because of it. Let's talk about this one, about how investigators, this person arranged multiple structure fires as part of insurance scheme. The guy in our area, he wasn't doing it as insurance scheme. It was just an arson. But let's talk about this one who did a sort of like a planned arson ring for insurance fraud.
Yeah. So remember that, you know, most arsons for profit. Mm. And, you know, I mean, obviously there's going to be a small amount that are arsons for retribution or arsons because they're upset with somebody. But the reality of it is that most arsons, especially businesses or home properties, are being done for insurance benefits. And, you know, it really does, it puts a lot of people at risk. And as you mentioned, you know, one case involved the death of a fireman. There was one case a couple of years ago where two brothers collaborated in burning one of the brothers' houses down. And they did such a good job they blew up four houses in their neighborhood, causing severe property damage and bodily injury to several of their neighbors. So, it's just another opportunity for people to commit insurance fraud. I mean, this one downstate, we've seen cases like this. And Patricia, I've been in this for 45 years, investigating insurance fraud. The Alliance has been talking about the problem of fraud for 28 years in the state of New York. And this is something that, we've seen often throughout all those years, especially in my career, is people will use their property coverage to try to get money that they're not entitled to. I mean, so what are the drivers of it? Maybe they're behind, they're having financial issues. They're having mortgage issues. And unfortunately, the way the system works, if they burn their own house down and they have a mortgage, the insurance company, and thereby the citizenry is on the hook to pay the mortgage off, even if that person burned the house down themselves. So it is one of those crimes that we see quite often in the New York area.
So let's talk about after the accident. What red flags should customers watch for when I'm dealing with either repair shops or contractors or healthcare providers or anyone who offers to handle insurance claim for them?
Right. One of the big red flags that we talk about is, and this is especially around the downstate area that that you're talking about, is if you're involved in an accident and say somebody suggests, hey, you need to take this car to this body shop, all right, be a little wary of that. Now, it could be very innocent, okay, but in a lot of cases, we have a problem down in our area called predatory towing, and in a lot of cases, unscrupulous tow operators are driving people to a specific body shop for the purpose of to allow that body shop to potentially commit fraud. Now, don't get me wrong, the vast majority of the body shops and tow operators are good, honest, hardworking people. But there is an element that are gonna be out there to try to game the system. The second thing is, if you get a notice from a third party, an attorney, maybe you'll get a letter from the attorney that says something to the effect of, hey, we understand you were in an accident. If you come to us, we can help you out. Be a little wary of that as well, all right? Because, we're seeing a lot of this where, runners are getting involved. They're getting copies of police reports, referring people to certain unscrupulous attorneys, all designed to try to game the system.
Right. Frank, I know we're running out of time here. Before we leave, do we see if you have anything else that we have not discussed that you want our listeners to know about insurance fraud?
I think one of the things that we want to, we certainly want to get out is, especially with the work that we're doing at the Alliance, is we're trying to make life in New York more affordable. Okay. And, the cost of insurance is high. And, fighting insurance fraud is a distinct way that we can try to help people make their lives more affordable. And the good news is New York is stepping up enforcement. The Governor Hochul in her budget has put money into the budget to tighten up on the investigation of potentially staged accidents. So, a good oversight by the state, good oversight by the insurance companies to take fraud seriously. This is all very important to try to stem the tide of insurance fraud.
We were talking to spokesperson for the New York Alliance Insurance Fraud and Senior Vice President of Investigative Services for the Delta Group. And we discussed several of the New York's most unusual alleged insurance fraud schemes and the financial impact fraud can have on policyholders and emerging trends involving stage accidents and healthcare claims, and warning signs consumers should recognize. And New Yorkers who suspect insurance fraud can report to the State Department of Financial Services by calling 888-FRAUD-NEW-YORK or submitting a report online. Frank, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Patricia, thank you so much for having me.
Big thanks to Patricia Rubio for that interview. And thank you, listener, for being here with me. I'm Jason Dole, and that is it for the Local Edition tonight. Coming up at 7, we got Trailer Talk with Sabrina Artel. But before that, coming up next, it's The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.